This will come back to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3983. And Speaker Simmons. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you, colleagues, for giving me this opportunity to testify before you today. I am State Representative Mark Simmons. I am the state legislator from House District 58, beautiful town of Elgin, beautiful northeast Oregon. Privileged to be spending my winter here in the Willamette Valley and serving as Speaker of the House. Thank you again for hearing 3983. Colleagues, the energy crisis and in California and drought conditions here in Oregon have heightened the need to protect access to low-cost power, develop a greater supply of energy, and encourage conservation. These drought conditions will continue to reduce the amount of energy that is produced locally. The energy crisis in California has forced Oregon producers to ship energy south. California's crisis has contributed to the high price of energy on the wholesale market, driving up costs locally when additional energy must be purchased. And the Bonneville Power Administration has stated that it cannot meet local demand without reaching out to its high-priced wholesale market. The legislature is working with Oregonians to meet these challenges and craft a sound, long-term energy policy for the state of Oregon. On April 12th, I stated that we must seek a delay to Oregon's existing energy restructuring legislation prior to its implementation on October 1st. To address the additional concerns about rising energy prices and uncertainties in the electricity market, I have sponsored House Bill 3983. This proposed delay is the final piece of legislation to what is a good, solid, bipartisan package of energy bills that provide greater energy supply, encourage conservation, and protect low-income ratepayers. House Bill 3983 will address certain issues associated with Oregon's restructuring legislation passed in 1999. This legislation represents a 15-month delay to Oregon's energy restructuring legislation. Under House Bill 3983, no customer will be forced to leave the current regulated rate structure. It creates a safe harbor of regulated, cost-based rates for Oregon energy consumers. This legislation does not restrict consumers' options to address other rate packages or to choose other rate packages. House Bill 3983 preserves the ability for commercial customers to make good business decisions and the flexibility to purchase power from other sources other than their own utility. This legislation provides Oregonians with the certainty they gain from continuing the same regulated energy rate structure they have right now. House Bill 3983 does not repeal Oregon's energy restructuring legislation. It merely delays the move away from the traditional regulated cost-based rates that would have taken place on October 1. This legislation allows the Public Utility Commission to maintain its regulatory authority over Oregon's energy rates. House Bill 3983 allows the PUC to continue to offer the same regulated cost-based rate structure beyond December 2002 by action of that body. This legislation guarantees ongoing cost-based rate for all residential customers. Matter of fact, Senate Bill 1149 from the last legislative session does not allow for residential customers ever to be forced to market. House Bill 3983 would require electric companies to provide all retail electricity consumers with regulated cost-based rates through December 31, 2002. This legislation preserves one of the cornerstones of Oregon's electricity restructuring plan, a ratepayer-funded program to assist low-income ratepayers in further weatherization and conservation goals. House Bill 3983 maintains the public purposes charges included in Oregon's restructuring legislation. This legislation allows the state to get beyond the crisis in California and assess the full impact it will have on Oregon before moving forward. Increasing supply, encouraging conservation, and providing assistance to low-income ratepayers are all play key roles in the ability to protect Oregon's access to low-cost power. In addition to House Bill 3983, the legislature's bipartisan energy package includes the following: Senate Bill 483, a short-term siting and energy assistance bill. House Bill 3788, directed to long-term siting of energy facilities issues. Senate Bill 520 and Senate Bill 521, which provide incentives for conservation. Passage of this bipartisan legislative package, I think, should include House Bill 3983, and it will help Oregon meet its energy challenges and develop a sound long-term energy policy for the state. That's why I'm requesting that you please support House Bill 3983 and send it to the vote of the House with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Gardner.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. Why December 31st, 2002?
The date was established through several discussions, and I believe that the deadline was chosen. The date we did choose was in consultation with numerous stakeholders involved in energy, and it reflects their needs as well as a natural timeline. December 31 of 2002. The lake can go beyond that by simple rule of the PUC. They can rule to extend the date. January 1, 2003 was the natural timeline.
Why not make it July, where the legislature, the 2003 legislative session, could deal with the issue should they decide to?
The year break was a natural break. I believe the 15 months beyond October this fall will provide an opportunity for the market to settle. And hopefully next year will bring us a lot more rain, and we won't have the drought conditions, hopefully, that we are dealing with today. And hopefully by then the situation in California will have settled somewhat.
Just one comment is I simply think that rather than a delay, this is an implementation bill. If you don't extend it beyond January 1st, if you don't make it into July where the next legislative session can deal with it, and they can understand, they can look at this, you know, what happens in California and deal with it, and certainly would hope you'd consider an amendment to this bill to make it July 1st.
Chair Wilson, Representative Gardner, the next legislative session will have every ability, as this current legislature does, to make adjustments to current law. And they would have the opportunity to make adjustments at that time should they see fit.
Mr. Speaker, if I might just, but it would add an increased level of difficulty for them, too, if the PUC decided to go ahead and implement, it was already implemented by the time they came into session, it would be a lot harder to go backwards for them than it would be simply to have it July the 1st where it would not be implemented yet.
Chair Wilson, Representative Gardner, I appreciate the concern. If the PUC should so order, they could extend it further.
Thank you. Further questions? Appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Representative Ackerman, please. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. My name is Robert Ackerman. I'm a state representative from District 39, which is north and west Eugene. My testimony today is directed to House Bill 3983 and the Dash 3 amendments, which I think have been distributed to you, which I have prepared and I am sponsoring. When I signed up this afternoon, I checked that I was both for and against the House Bill 3963. I probably did that because I recognized that we are attempting a bipartisan approach to this, and through the courtesy of the Speaker, I did attend one work session, which I think was directed to the formulation of his bill, House Bill 3963. Upon reflection, I felt that there were some omissions in that bill, and there should be some technical adjustments, which are the subject of my Dash 3 amendments. First, however, I'd like to give you just a brief review of current law because it does fit quite well within what we are attempting to do with the Dash 3 amendments this afternoon. Senate Bill 1149 was passed by the last legislative session, And in general terms, large commercial and industrial customers of our investor-owned utilities would be required to purchase electricity by direct access after October 1 of this year. This means they must leave their originating utility and purchase electricity in an unregulated wholesale market. These commercial and industrial customers may elect to return to their originating utility. However, then they must purchase electricity from their originating utility at a default rate, which would be much larger or higher than the cost of service rate, or higher even than the standard offer, because it was the intention of the drafters of 1149 to keep these large commercial and industrial customers in the unregulated wholesale market. That was the purpose of direct access, is to create this market. Senate Bill 1149 then provided for a divestiture process by which generating assets of the investor-owned utilities could be purchased by third parties. It was anticipated that this generating capacity would be sold to independent entities and provide electricity to the large commercial and industrial customers who were required to seek direct access in this unregulated wholesale market. Senate Bill 1149, therefore, was committed to a policy of divestiture. The regulations adopted by our commission provide for a divestiture process and the evaluation of investor-owned generating assets in contemplation of their sale. This is found in Section 6 of the Act, and I might state parenthetically and off my testimony here at this point that Commissioner Ickes has conceded that Section 6 should be repealed, and my bill repealing Section 6 has been incorporated in an amendment to one of the siting bills that's now in the House Ways and Means Joint Ways and Means Committee. Regarding House Bill 3983 specifically, as I mentioned, it was a product of a short work session when I participated with the Speaker. And in general terms, it directs that a cost of service rate option would be provided to retail electricity customers through December 31, 2002. Thereafter, a cost of service rate option may be extended by the PUC. This bill has some interesting features but needs clarification in order to more fully protect the public. The primary fault in the bill is that the cost of service rate option expires by its own terms on December 31, 2002. The PUC, quote, may, unquote, conduct a hearing to extend the date. However, this authority appears discretionary, and there's no time period within which the PUC may act. If the PUC acts after January 1, 2003, the cost of service option will have already expired. Large commercial and industrial customers would then be thrust into the unregulated wholesale market pending a PUC hearing in order to determine the cost of service rate option and whether it should be extended. We see that as a major flaw because, as I mentioned, the cost of service option rate expires by its own terms. This law will, therefore, will cause economic dislocation and uncertainty. In addition, there are no standards to which the PUC must direct its hearing process in order to determine whether the cost of service option should be extended. The current bill, therefore, gives the PUC a blank check to set its own standards as to what may be in the public interest in coming to a conclusion as to whether the cost of service option should be extended or terminated. I believe we cannot give the PUC that much latitude and discretion in this important issue. The PUC, as I have said, under SB 1149, is still committed to direct access based upon the false notion that this would relate in the accumulation of capital to be utilized for the construction of additional generating facilities. Likewise, under the bill before you, the PUC does not have to direct its hearing process to any findings with respect to the volatility of the market, the wholesale market, or the cost to the customers when they are released into the unregulated wholesale market. For these reasons, the public interest must be more adequately protected. The Dash 3 amendments clarifies the hearing process and provides for greater protection to Oregon ratepayers. This amendment provides that the cost of service rate option shall continue until August 1, 2003. On or after that date, the PUC may rescind the cost of service rate option pursuant to a public hearing. However, it may only rescind the cost of service rate option if it finds by a preponderance of the evidence that providing direct access to retail electric customers will not result in materially higher electric rates compared to the cost of service rate, and any increase in electric costs resulting from direct access will not result in substantial curtailment of economic activity or substantial unemployment of persons employed by customers of electric companies. So in other words, what we're saying here is that the PUC, the cost of service option, extends through August and thereafter, and can only be rescinded by a PUC order pursuant to a due process hearing and based upon the findings which I have just mentioned to you. Senate Bill 1149 was committed to direct access regardless of economic circumstances and without regard to the public interest. This amendment, which I have proposed, substantially changes that direction. It provides maximum protection for all ratepayers and allows the movement to direct access only after the interest of the public has been safeguarded by a public hearing before the PUC. The amendment also corrects deficiencies in House Bill 3983, which only creates uncertainty with respect to direct access, the extension of the cost of service rate option, and the role of the PUC in protecting the public interest. I believe that if we gave the authority to the PUC, as I have suggested this afternoon, to conduct a hearing and make findings before direct access would be authorized, that it will certainly circumvent a lot of the argument and debate in the next legislative assembly about these issues, because the issue then would be squarely before the PUC, which is probably best equipped through the evidence taking that they can conduct and the investigation they can conduct and the witnesses which can participate in the proceeding to provide a decision that would be in the public interest. I believe the PUC, with the guidelines I have suggested, would be the best forum for the discussion of those issues and could probably make a better decision under those circumstances than could the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ackerman. Any questions? Okay. Thank you.
Fine. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Representatives Litt and Close. Good afternoon.
Go ahead. Thank you, Chair Wilson, and members of the House Rules, Redistricting, and Public Affairs Committee for hearing House Bill 3983. For the record, I'm Betsy Close, State Representative from District 36. Several of my constituents have expressed concerns about power restructuring in Oregon. I drafted House Bill 3633 and am co-sponsoring this bill, House Bill 3983, for this reason. The bill would put into law what I and Senator Yee requested during the interim, that small companies would not be forced to go to market prematurely. This is a positive addition to Senate Bill 1149, which was passed last session. And I've attached a letter from the Albany Chamber of Commerce urging your support for this bill, and I would just like to put in the record their letter. Dear Chairman Wilson, on behalf of the Albany Chamber of Commerce, I am pleased to extend our support to House Bill 3983 that will provide all retail electricity consumers with a cost of service rate option through December 31st, 2002. The Chamber recognizes the enormous complexity of this issue and thanks the many sponsors of House Bill 3983 for recognizing the importance of the cost of service rate for businesses. By providing this cost of service rate option for Oregon's retail customers for an additional 15 months, October 1st, 2001 to December 31st, 2002, you are providing small and large businesses alike the opportunity to mitigate higher energy costs that could cause severe financial hardships and business closures during our countries and, more importantly, the West Coast energy crisis. In addition, House Bill 3983 allows the PUC to continue providing a cost of service rate option to retail customers after December 31st, 2002, should a public hearing determine that is the correct path to take. The Albany Chamber thanks you for your diligence on this matter and urges you to support and pass House Bill 3983. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I appreciate this opportunity to give testimony today on House Bill 3983. I am here today to testify in support of House Bill 3983 and in opposition to the Dash 3 amendments that have been offered. And if we look at the problem on the West Coast today relative to energy, it is basically a problem between supply and demand. Throughout the 90s, we've had a rapidly increasing demand, but very little additional supply that has become available. And of course, we've seen the application of that problem in California in the last year or two, particularly with a very flawed 1996 California Act that required the incumbent utilities to divest themselves of their generating facilities and then required them to go out on the short-term market and buy power in a market which had too little supply and too much demand. While the prediction, of course, is obvious, prices skyrocket in that situation, and that's what's happened in California. Senate Bill 1149, which was passed in the 1999 session of the Oregon legislature, of course, is radically different from that. Does not require divestiture. It does not set up the requirement that everybody goes to market. It was very much a phased-in, a very cautious approach to electricity restructuring. But because of the problems in California and the supply and demand problems that exist today in the electricity markets on the West Coast, this legislature in 2001 has taken a series of intelligent, rational steps to start to deal with the problem. We've passed Senate Bill 843 in both houses. That bill, if you recall, Mr. Chairman and members, expedites short-term siting so that we can get more electricity running in the ground available for sale here in Oregon this year. Senate Bill, House Bill 3788, which is a long-term siting bill, expedites siting strategies so that over the next 2 to 3 years we can add significant capacity here in Oregon. House Bill 3790, which provides some optional tax incentives for local communities to attract the economic development from siting. And House Bill 2075, which was ultimately incorporated into Senate Bill 843, which provides low-income bill payment assistance for low-income Oregonians. All of these are intelligent, rational steps to try to bring into balance supply and demand. House Bill 3983 continues to provide the same opportunity to larger commercial and industrial customers that Senate Bill 1149 does, namely the opportunity to go to market if they can make a price arrangement, a contract with a generator that is favorable to that company. That's good economic development, because if a larger company can enter into a contract with a third-party generator and lower its costs, that's good for Oregon. It'll help keep jobs here. It'll help to lead to the development of more jobs here. But with House Bill 3983, we do not compel the larger commercial customer or the industrial customer to go to market. They can continue to get from their incumbent utility a cost of service rate just like they do today. And that protection would continue for another 15 months all the way through December 31st, 2002. Now, the question came up, and it came from Representative Gardner, why that date? Why December 31, 2002? I think the answer to that, Mr. Chairman, is fairly obvious. It's called market certainty. Because if we want all these generating companies to come into Oregon to invest the hundreds of millions of dollars that it takes to site a new plant, we have to let them know that we have a clear path here to electricity restructuring, not a path for the next year and a half, and then the 2003 legislature is going to change it, and then the 2005 legislature is going to change it, and the 2007 legislature is going to change it. One thing that markets have, particularly when it comes to the types of investments that we're talking about here, is some certainty. So that those who are investing the dollars into these new generating facilities know what the ground rules are going to be. So I think this bill, the bill that has been offered by Speaker Simmons, makes absolute sense. Because it says we're going to extend these protections for the next 15 months. We're not going to force anybody to go to market. If you want, you can get a cost of service rate. However, if you want to go to market and that's good for your business and it's good for local communities, you can go to market and work on a contract that makes sense for your business. But we also know that come December 31, 2002, there's a date in which we have a certainty here where the market fully is allowed to develop for these bigger commercial and industrial customers. The other thing I would point out is that in Senate Bill 1149, we did not require divestiture of generating plants for incumbent utilities the way that the California statute did.
And then this session, we have incorporated a clear provision in law that the PUC cannot in any way create incentives for or require divestiture of generating facilities. So the utilities that are affected, which are Portland General and PacifiCorp, can continue to maintain the generating facilities that they have today. And in fact, they have to continue to be able to provide the power that they need to provide for the customers that they have to continue to service. So I think when you look at this in whole, this makes sense. It allows the electricity restructuring to go forward in a phased-in way. It creates market certainty for those who are going to invest the hundreds of millions of dollars that these new generating plants provide. But it does move forward in a positive way to allow business and particularly larger industrial customers to go to market and to get the best arrangement they can in terms of their power. Throughout this all, residential ratepayers are absolutely protected. They continue to buy the power the way they've always bought their power. The smaller business customers continue to buy the power the way they've always bought their power. And also with House Bill 3983, the public purposes, the 3% charge goes into effect October 1, which will help in terms of weatherization, conservation, and market transformation. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm strongly in support of House Bill 3983. I think it's right for Oregon. I think the Dash 3 amendments only allow for more, ultimately more meddling in this policy. I don't think that's good. I think we need to have the market certainty to move forward in a cautious, rational approach, and I think House Bill 3983 does that.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Garrard.
Representative Witt, I want to make sure I understand what you just said. A shorter date of implementation adds certainty. A later date adds to uncertainty.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garrard, yes. I think if we delay the implementation of direct access for the larger customers, the larger industrial commercial customers, past the next legislative session, what we are telling is that to the generators that have to invest the money to locate these facilities, you better not do this until after 2003 because the legislature may go and change the law again. I think what we have to do is we have to create some market certainty so that they feel comfortable now in terms of investing the dollars that are going to be critical to Oregonians having the power that they need in the next 2 to 3 years. So I think if you adopt the Dash 3 amendments, I think what you're doing is you're undermining the very policy that we've been supporting in Senate Bill 843, House Bill 3788, and House Bill 3790, where we are trying to incent and remove regulatory barriers out of the way from new generating capacity. And I think that would be an enormous mistake, and I think Oregon would pay a tremendous price if we adopted the Dash 3s and had this kind of market uncertainty.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up. So what you're saying is the big industrial buyers would trust the PUC but would not trust the legislature.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garrard, what I'm saying is these investments, which can take in some cases 2 and 3 years to see through to fruition, likely will not be made if the belief is that the legislature is going to constantly be changing the policy. Because part of the incentive for these generators to come in and make the investment and site these facilities now is that they believe under current law there will be a marketplace there where they will be able to sell their power to a variety of different customers, not just an incumbent utility, but directly to an Intel, directly to a Pope and Talbot, directly to a Weyerhaeuser, directly to a large hospital or a consortium of hospitals. What Senate Bill 1149 and House Bill 3983 allow to happen is they allow for these generators to have a marketplace to sell to. And if we delay the implementation of direct access for these larger industrial customers beyond the next legislative session, what we're doing is we're taking away that market certainty of having a market to sell to. And I think that would have a chilling effect on new investors.
Other questions? Representative March.
Thank you. So if I follow that argument, you would remove the power of the commission to order the cost of service rate option available to other two of the big users.
Mr. Chairman, Representative March, no. I think what House Bill 3983 says is that on or after January 1, 2003, there's a certain discretion vested in the Public Utility Commission in terms of making sure that the move to direct access does not have negative repercussions for Oregon, and I think that's appropriate. And the PUC has a general responsibility when it comes to utility operations, particularly investor-owned utility operations in the state. And I think it's appropriate to continue to grant them some discretion in those matters.
follow up.
So other than the uncertainty provided by PUC in this date, are you also saying about the legislature meddling in the process that the getting rid of the divestiture Section 6 was a bad move by this legislature?
Mr. Chairman, Representative March, not at all. I think, in fact, by the way, Ron Ekus from the PUC has testified that they never intended to create any incentives for divestiture. Senate Bill 1149 allowed them the opportunity, if they decided to create some incentives for divestiture, not to command it, not to order it, but allowed them in Section 6 to have some incentives for divestiture if they thought that was the best way to open up the marketplace. What we've done here is we've simply confirmed in legislation this session, confirmed what the PUC intended to do, and that is they are not to order divestiture or in any way pressure or set policies that require a incumbent utility to divest of assets, but that the utility has the option of divesting where it makes sense, but it's not in any way forced to, compelled to, or incented to do so.
Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank you both for bringing this bill and for your expertise on the issue, Representative Witt. I appreciate that. The question I have is the bill is passed as it's printed. Large businesses still have the option to go to market now. That's correct. They don't have to wait until January 1st of 2003.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Starr, that's correct. Starting October 1, 2001, they will have the option, if it makes sense for their business, to go to market and buy the power directly from a generator instead of buying it through the incumbent utility. But it's their option to do that. And that in House Bill 3983 preserves that option.
And just one quick follow-up. And so then January 1st, 2003, the option for them to stay under the cost of service rate is taken away. They're forced then to go to market.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Starr, that's correct. And again, I think that the policy behind that is that we're trying to create a marketplace here and to get the generators to invest the dollars that it will take to meet the needs, the power needs of Oregonians going forward. Then we need to have some certainty that we're going to have some kind of a marketplace to sell into.
Other questions? All right, representatives, thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
Thank you.
Next up will be Greg Miller. And I think Greg is going to be accompanied by several friends. And I will let you introduce them all, Mr. Miller, if you would like. For the record, I'd like to say that we have letters from PGE and PacifiCorp. And I'd also like to mention I'll probably make a decision here in about 10 minutes or so if we need to drop anything from our schedule today. Welcome to committee.
Thank you, Chair Wilson, members of the committee. I'm going to dispense of the introduction and let each one of our members of the panel introduce themselves. And as you can see, we're about a chair short, so I would be doing Andrea a disservice by not being able to introduce her collectively. So I'll just go ahead and start off with my testimony, and then we'll continue on through. And we'll rotate chairs, and I'll give her my chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Greg Miller. I'm the co-chair of the Business Customer Coalition. This coalition includes members of Associated Oregon Industries, Industrial Customers of Northwest Utilities, Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and the Oregon Restaurant Association, as well as the American Electronics Association. Commercial and industrial customers worked for passage and implementation of Senate Bill 1149. We believe that Senate Bill 1149 and its implementing rules contain significant customer protections and afford a great deal of flexibility in how we meet the objective of competitive electricity sources. The energy shortage, drought conditions in the Northwest, and California's poorly drafted energy deregulation plan are causing disruptions in the wholesale market, power market, that neither the business community nor the legislature could predict when Senate Bill 1149 was passed. House Bill 3983 provides a 15-month cushion for business customers. Under House Bill 3983, customers will be afforded a regulated cost of service rate that is similar to what they pay now. This is a safe harbor. I'd like to underscore that. This is a safe harbor that will provide that provides additional customer protection, which is important in the current market environment. This bill allows business customers who are ready to go, who are ready and willing to go to market. House Bill 3983, in combination with the short and long-term siting bills moving this session, which you heard described to you earlier, form an appropriate and effective package of legislation to address our energy crisis, and therefore we urge your support for this bill.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I guess I'm going to go next. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Libby Henry. I represent the Eugene Water and Electric Board. EWEB is a municipal utility that serves both power and water to the city of Eugene. We are also a generating utility, and we have a trading floor, so we buy and sell wholesale power on the market. And so I'd like to share with you today our concern about the market and what can happen depending upon what this body decides to do. And I also will be speaking to the value of certainty, so this will be a little bit repetitive of what you heard from Representative Witt, but it will be from the vantage point of a utility. As you know, we have a shortage of energy, and therefore we need power plants. And as long as we have a shortage, we're going to have high rates. So it's in our interest to site plants in the state of Oregon as soon as we can. When the federal government deregulated wholesale power, there was this birth of these independent power producers, private companies to build power plants. And at that time, the large investor-owned utilities stopped building power plants. And if you were to look at the Energy Facilities Siting Council application for building power plants in Oregon today, you would see they are all independent power producers ready to come into our state to build power plants and provide power for all of us. When the state of Oregon passed Senate Bill 1149, that sent a message to the market and these independent power producers that they would have customers to sell to here. And again, as soon as they get into the state of Oregon and build power plants, the sooner our rates go down because the market stabilizes. Our concern, of course, is if Oregon does not send a consistent message to the marketplace, decides to delay or repeal 1149, we'll be telling those power producers that they no longer have a market here. If they go forward and build in Oregon, they have no impetus to sell in Oregon. That protracts a power shortage and the high rates that we're having today. So our support of House Bill 3983 is based on the fact that we believe it provides some consistency and the certainty needed to go ahead and implement 1149. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jason Eisdorf with the Citizens Utility Board. We represent residential customers before the Public Utility Commission and in the legislature. This bill does not have any effect on the on residential customers and small commercial customers from what is in 1149 as it now stands. It doesn't change any of the protections in 1149 for the small customers. The cost of service rate stays for residential and small commercial customers in perpetuity. The protections against cost shifting between customer classes if a industrial customer does choose to go to market is still in effect. The public purposes piece, which is now a truly essential part of 1149 and provides funding for energy efficiency spending and low-income bill payment assistance, will continue on, and that is very significant because the current high market rates will create unavoidable rate increases, even for the cost of service rates. So having the public purposes continue on is extremely important. What House Bill 3983 does do that's different from 1149 is that it mandates the Public Utility Commission to offer a cost of service rate for the large commercial and industrial customers. This is the functional equivalent of delaying the entire bill. The reason one would delay the entire bill would be to allow customers to have a cost of service rate. And what this does is allows industrial customers that choice of a cost of service rate or the ability to go to market. We think it's a reasonable and sane way to proceed. And Mr. Chair, if I could give a third answer to the question of why this date, December 31, 2002, It's more from a practical standpoint. The initial discussion had the mandate of cost of service rate moved out 1 year from the October 2001 date. What that would do is get customers through two summers of the current energy crisis, and hopefully by that point new resources would come online and prices would go down. I think PGE at that point reminded us that in going forward, they've already made purchases through December 31, 2003. And so we actually, the date was initially a year, and we extended it out to 15 months in consistent with what PGE had been planning forward. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Andrea Fogg with the League of Oregon Cities. There are 240 cities in Oregon. Approximately 142 of them are served by investor-owned utilities, and the remainder are served by consumer-owned utilities. As you know, this issue has been a tough issue for cities. There are some cities around the state that have passed resolutions supporting delay of implementation of 1149. Last Friday, the League's Board of Directors, which represents the cities in Oregon, voted to support the Speaker's delay, the proposal involved in House Bill 3983. This is a very important bill because it provides additional consumer protections. No one will be forced to go to the market. This will allow large and small consumers to have cost-based regulated rates. This will give critical time for the market to really settle out and to address consumer concerns, things that are very important to cities. In addition, the bill really allows some time to focus on the supply problems that we are currently experiencing, in particular supply demand and not having enough generation online. And this version of the bill of delay of 1149 would also allow public purpose provisions to move forward, and those are critical also to being able to mitigate some of the current market impacts. And for those reasons, the League supports the Speaker's proposal, House Bill 3983.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for our panel? Representative Virgin.
Yes, I'd like to ask several questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, with EWEB, do I understand that you support this bill, but you actually really support no repeal or delay?
Oh, we support this bill because we think that it'll add some certainty and some comfort being able to provide these customers with this cost of service rate for an additional 15 months, and therefore put off the desire to repeal or delay 1149.
Part of yours is based on the investment of new generating plants. Large companies that are going to come in and site energy plants here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Could you be more specific for me? You know of people. I don't have
Absolutely.
Any letters
I'm obvious to
in front of me.
To represent some interests that are citing plants in Oregon.
Okay. Because I have no testimony or letters in front of me that says, gee, I'm company XYZ, and if you do this, I'm going to come right into Oregon and site plants.
Representative Berger, I'd be happy to supply you with a list. We'll show you the stages of all which these companies are in and where they are in the siting process and who's lined up ready to go and who should be online within the next 2 to 3 years. That all can be supplied by the siting council for you.
Next 2 or 3 years?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're beginning first plant on this late summer, this next fall, and then out into the future.
Okay. Follow up, please. My next question is for you, Greg. Would you like to come back and change places with Andrea, maybe? As you know, there are areas of Oregon that have a lot of unemployment and are very dependent on the few jobs that we have left, and my area on the South Coast is one, but certainly not the only one. My question is, for a large industrial customer, would 15 months really mean much of anything to a large industrial customer? You talked about it kind of smoothing out decisions.
Chair, Representative Verger, I think the simple answer is yes. The market's very volatile at the present time. And for example, in your district, we have our North Bend facility, I think you're fairly familiar with that facility there. And being able to have this cushion and have this certainty around the cost of service rate as opposed to jumping out into the market, I think would be a very welcomed safe harbor for them. So, and I think from the standpoint of their operations there, that is a good cushion for that kind of facility.
So I am to understand now, I want to be really clear with you, that this is going to help create market certainty in a different way, not market certainty for the electrical companies, but market certainty for the people in my area whom your company employs.
I believe so.
You believe so?
For the questions, Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Miller, were you around last session with the discussions of 1149?
Chair Wilson, Representative March, yes, I was.
Oh, great.
Follow up?
Yes, thank you. At that time, how many of your business customer coalition members plan to go to the market about now, and how many currently want to go to the market now?
Representative Wilson, or Chair Wilson, Representative March, I really couldn't answer that for you. That's a great question. I don't have those numbers in my back pocket.
Thank you.
Anything further? Representative Devlin.
Let me ask a hypothetical question. Let's say the speaker's bill passed. I'm a co-sponsor on the speaker's bill, so I kind of hope that the speaker's bill passes for some version. But let's say we get into 6 months before this implementation date when you'll be forced to go to market. And we're in an extremely unstable situation then, far more unstable than we are now. And we're quite unstable as it is. What do you think the possibilities are that we might be called back into session to delay the implementation at that point?
Chair Wilson, Representative Devlin, I don't believe that anybody will be forced to go to market the way Senate Bill 1149 is written. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
So I appreciate your hypothetical, but I believe that we'll continue to have the options in Senate Bill 1149. We'll be able to assess the marketplace as it develops, and that's the kind of certainty that we need, and I think that's the kind of certainty that the whole issue needs.
Would you, Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to follow all the amendments and different versions of this, but you would not be forced into the market. You might be forced into not a cost of service, but a standard offer, if that's the difference that you'd have.
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, that's correct. It's the after this date, a large commercial industrial customer would have the option of going to market or staying on the standard offer, which is a combination of market but also the value of the existing resources that the utility has. So it's going to be much more like the cost of service rate than it is going to be like what you all are thinking of the market rate out there right now. These customers will continue to get the value of those.
Somewhere in the middle, actually. Probably.
Hypothetically.
All the certainty we do have.
One other point there is that the bill currently does give the commission the ability to grant a cost of service rate for industrial and commercials. What HB 3983 does is mandate it for this period of time, but beyond that, the commission could continue it.
Further questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Roy Hemingway from the governor's office is right here. Okay, I don't see him here. I have no one else to testify. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3983. Some of you in the audience are looking a little bleary-eyed. I think we'll change subjects here for you. I'm going to say this. There's a strong possibility we're not going to get to House Bill 2123. I've got to go pick up on some work sessions here of some things we've done previously. We could get to it, but I don't think we will. All right, I'd like to open a work session, House Bill 3686.
And Brian DeMarco and Audrey Klein, please. Director, Mr. DeMarco, welcome to the Rules Committee.
Chairman Wilson, members of the committee, my name is Brian DeMarco, Assistant to the Commissioner at the Oregon Real Estate Agency. House Bill 3686 was introduced by Representative Merkley at the request of the Attorney General's Task Force on Manufactured Housing. One of the principal recommendations that came out of that task force was to provide a vehicle so that renters and tenants in manufactured home parks may purchase individual ownership interests. A number of options were bandied about, and the revisions to the subdivision law was basically the recommendation that came about. The proposed amendments have been reviewed by Cheryl Pellegrini on behalf of the Department of Justice, who has reviewed and approved the amendment as to form and as to legal sufficiency. The essence of this amendment is to cut away the red tape of the subdivision laws in the state and local governments so that existing manufactured home parks may have a subdivided property and that the individual tenants may purchase these interests. In the likely scenario, the subdivisions would come in under the Planned Community Act as a planned unit development where the existing infrastructure would be owned by an association and that the individual owners of the lots would be members of this association. It simply is to provide a mechanism that allows these manufactured park owners to not have to deal with the costly and time-consuming red tape of local ordinances. Because these parks exist in their state now, they are there, and all we would be doing under this amendment is creating a form of ownership, not changing the characteristics. And at this point, I'll defer to your questions, and thank you.
Sure, thank you. Questions from the committee? Just very briefly, let's talk about a new park coming online and how would this look?
It would not impact new parks at all. This would only impact a park in existence as of
David. Right. Okay. And any questions? Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have is, has local cities and counties and their representatives in this building been part of the discussion about this?
Chair Wilson, Representative Starr, to my knowledge, they have not.
Any idea why they have not?
I don't. I represent Chairman Wilson, members of the committee. It's been rather in the forefront. I'm sort of amazed that there are no representatives of the cities and the counties or D.C. outside D.C. to come in and comment on the proposal, since it does affect local counties and cities. I frankly expected such.
Yeah. When, Mr. Chair.
Representative Starr.
When the Dash 2 amendments say the governing body of a city or county shall, generally we have city or county representatives in the room. If we're telling them they have to do something or another, they usually have a comment about that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd be interested to know if, I don't see Andrea must have left after the last hearing. But.
Well, I tend to like the bill, and I would expect that we would see them on the Senate side. I certainly would. And if we don't, all right. Director Refine.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, for the record, I am Bob Refine, Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. As Mr. DeMarco has mentioned, the the essence of this amendment that you're considering today is the results of the Attorney General's task force that was convened prior to this session. It was their finding number 20 that makes those recommendations to allow for conversion of existing manufactured parks into an, either a subdivision or a plan unit development. This has been an issue for ever since 1991 session when we defined the ombudsman program, and we also created a park purchase opportunity. Nearly has there been any successes in the park purchase side. There has been over 40 attempts trying to put together 10, 20, or 100 residents in a park to come to some agreement on how they, as a collective group, would buy a park as a as an organization. But as you can imagine, the complexity of that, it falls apart relatively quick when you start involving and engaging people's finances and disclosure of those finances. And so there hasn't been any successes. But in 1991, there was this idea set in place of how could we get or empower residents or tenants the ability to have either all or a portion of the ownership of a park. What you have in front of you today under this plan unit development concept is that tool. Now, what does that mean to the residents? It means, just to give you an example, is that many residents who get paid their taxes or their assessments on their units believe that their units have a, let's say, a $30,000 value. They turn around and they want to market it, and they find out that they can't get $15,000 for it for a variety of reasons. But generally, it's because there's no equity other than the unit, and there's the uncertainty of the cost and the uncertainty possibly of the long-term nature of it residing there. This bill would allow people to, through financing tools and opportunities, to become an acquirer of that true asset underneath their unit. And in cases where this has taken place before, not only have they been able to recover the investment of the land, but they've actually increased the value of the unit that they had assessed, so they actually would get something of a fair and equitable value as opposed to selling it at a fire discount. And so this does give those residents, those citizens of Oregon, an opportunity to vest in property, which then adds a higher value to their equity that they've put together and had and held for many years. It's a great opportunity. To the representative's question on the county and city representation, my only guess possibly would be Representative Starr, and just a guess, I'm assuming that those two organizations participated in the Attorney General's task force because there was much discussion about these issues that affected both counties and cities. As it came out as a recommendation in that report, it's possible that they have not found any fault with that and they're supporting it. That's just a possible answer to that question.
Thank you. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm supportive of this concept, but something you just said troubles me a little bit about selling that a portion of the park might be owned by the individual residents. And how do you see this not applying equally to the park? In other words, that the whole park would be up sit for sale individually, or that somebody keeps half of it for rental and the other half is by lot?
Chair Wilson, Representative March, if I may answer that. Under the concept of the planned unit development, the entire park would be subdivided, and those individual tenants would be given the opportunity to purchase their lot and then combine it with their manufactured home to create real property. Those other units that, for instance, a tenant decides not to purchase, the declarant or the developer would still own and control those lots, and the representative on the in the association and would be a pay-doing member of the association. And that's the general concept. And then if he or she would like to rent or lease out a certain number of the units, they may do that too.
As I understand, it's sort of like a condominium situation where the developer, in essence, in a condominium situation, and this is California law, so it's not necessarily applies here, but say someone develops a property they, in essence, maintain management of it until over a certain percentage of them are sold. So is that also the way that it works in the plan unit development concept here?
Chair Wilson, Representative March, yes, it is.
Okay.
Thank you. Further questions? All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. All right. We are in work session. I just wanted to talk to the committee. Any of you have any particular heartburn with this? I make a motion.
I move the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3686.
Thank you. Representative Starr moves the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3686. Do we have any objection? Any discussion first? Any objections? Any motion carries?
Okay.
Representative Starr.
Move that House Bill 3686 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Starr moves House Bill 3686 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Jennifer, if you'd call the roll, please.
Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Doyle?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Excuse.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative March?
Aye.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Walker?
Aye.
Chair Wilson?
Aye. And motion carries. And volunteer carry? Okay, Representative Starr will close the work session on House Bill 3686. Let's see. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 194. We've opened a public hearing on Senate Bill 194, and first up will be John Van Landingham. And John, I think you have some guests with you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. My name is John Van Landingham. I work as a lawyer for a legal services program in Lane County. I've been the principal drafter and a negotiator on behalf of tenants for amendments to the Oregon Residential Landlord and Tenant Act since 1991. Senate Bill 194 represents our biennial coalition compromise effort to produce changes that are acceptable to both landlords and tenants and other interest groups to the Landlord and Tenant Act. I have with me Emily Cedarleaf from Multifamily Housing Council of Oregon. I've been practicing the names of the various groups, and Chuck Carpenter from Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, a landlord group that represents solely park owners. I believe that Emily wants to say a few words.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. As you said, I'm Emily Cedarleaf, the director of Multifamily Housing Council of Oregon, and we are a trade association of about 3,700 members statewide that deal with single-family, multifamily, and mobile home parks, as well as some floating home parks. 1973, the landlord-tenant law was passed, and in 1975, the mobile home component of the statute was added. And in 1979, I was hired with the and charged with trying to make amendments to make the landlord-tenant law equitable between landlords and tenants. At the first sessions, it was Michael Marcus, the director of litigation for Legal Aid, and I that fought things out. And finally, a legislative committee in 1983 directed us to go out in the hall, and when we could agree and compromise, then they would listen to us. And from that point, the Landlord-Tenant Coalition was born. It grew from Michael Marcus and myself to, in 1991, I think we were at 6 members. This last session, between the mobile home group that met in the morning and the residential portion that met in the afternoon, we had 39 participants sitting at the table 8 hours almost every week for months. The goal of the coalition is that things be balanced between landlords and tenants. In my caveat has always been that if it's good for housing, it's good for landlords and it's good for tenants. It's not just good for one or the other. And so we have compromised. We have worked through issues. Frankly, everything landlords want are not in there. Everything that tenants want is not in there. And we did not mean to make a sweeping bill this time. Last time there were 450 some changes to the statute, and some of it were just words, but part of it was trying to get landlords caught up as to what everything meant this time. So this time we were going in and doing house cleaning on some Supreme Court cases. We were taking issues that court clerks had brought to us. We had been taking issues that were just cleanup. And then we also added some major components of the mobile home park process into this same bill. So this is the what we call the omnibus bill. We do have more amendments. We're not finished. And we will be ready to file what we call legislative intent, which is a section-by-section direction as to what we all think we all agreed on as we were going through this. There have been over 400 hours of negotiation in this, so this has not been a short process, but we beg your indulgence as we go through some of the final parts of all of this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chuck Carpenter, Executive Director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. And MHCO is generally very pleased with the omnibus bill. There are a few things still left that we would like to work on, and we've directed our attorney, Phil Quarin, to work with John Van Landingham to hammer out some of the final details, if, in fact, those things can be hammered out. I would like to express the appreciation of the association for your work, Mr. Chairman, in coming into the coalition on two occasions. I think your assistance and guidance helped produce this piece of legislation, and I hope you take some pride in what we've been able to put together. But you had a very calming influence on us all, and that is very much appreciated. But MHCO does feel that there are a few things that we'd like to continue to work on, and we've directed our attorney, Phil Quarin, to work with John to work those things out. I'd also like to express the appreciation of MHCO with regards to all the hours and time and patience that John Van Landingham has put into drafting this piece of legislation with our attorney. And he's one of the unsung heroes here, and the association very much appreciates the time that he's put in. Though we don't always agree with Mr. Van Landingham, but his efforts are appreciated.
Thank you. If I might add, Mr. Chairman, there have been two coalitions that have worked on this bill, a general landlord-tenant coalition and a manufactured housing coalition, because the two have different laws and some overlapping laws. Within those two coalitions, we've had five different landlord groups, four different tenant groups, housing authorities, Oregon Housing and Community Services Ombudsman Program facilitating it, manufacturers of manufactured housing, and Department of Revenue, assessors, lenders, and some individual lawyers. So we've had rather large groups working on this. As a result of Representative Wilson's assistance, we resolved four other issues that we would not have otherwise resolved, and those are yet to be printed. So 194A does not include all of our work. It's at the printer now, should be out of the printer at the end of this week, and then we need to proof it. And we're also still trying to negotiate a couple of smaller issues, which we may or may not succeed at.
Thank you. I appreciate your effort.
Thanks.
Any questions? Representative Berger.
I have a definition question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When the government inspector goes out to post, you're asking for a posting of unlawful and not unlawful and unsafe. Wonder if you might help define that for me.
Chair Wilson, Representative Berger, you would ask about the most complicated statute in the bunch.
Let me ask, Representative Berger, we're under time pressure. Could we authorize Mr. Van Landingham to give the executive summary?
Sure.
Thank you.
The executive summary is that there are two different situations, one in which a building truly is unsafe and the local government determines that it's unsafe and the occupant must be removed. The second is where the defect in the building does not make it unsafe, so that the tenant does not have to be removed, but rather it's a smaller issue and the local government will essentially
hold the unit hostage, not allow the landlord to re-rent it until that repair is made. The draft in the bill is wrong. It uses unsafe in both situations. In the second, not unsafe situation, it should not say unsafe, which is probably what created the confusion. Again, it is pretty complicated. I'd be glad to talk more privately later.
I understand.
Okay,
thank
great.
You for the clarification.
Thank you. I'm going to thank you for your testimony. I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill, Senate Bill 194A, and I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3983. And Roy Hemingway is here from the governor's office to deliver testimony. Good afternoon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for your indulgence in taking me at this time. I was on a conference call earlier that I couldn't avoid. I'm Roy Hemingway. I am testifying on behalf of the governor. I want to make that clear because next week I might be wearing a different hat, and I have not consulted the Public Utility Commission with respect to this testimony. The governor is in support of House Bill 3983. This bill is deceptively simple, and it does solve the problem that has been defined out there with respect to Senate Bill 1149 and the Oregon deregulation effort. And that problem is that people are worried that they will be thrown into a marketplace that can only be described simply as chaos right now. And although there are some protections built into Senate Bill 1149 to prevent that from happening, this language ensures that the kind of rate structure that they're accustomed to will be available to them for at least the next 20 months. And then we've got options further to prevent them from being thrown into the marketplace if those options are needed. I want to emphasize that this will not necessarily mean that there won't be rate increases for industrial customers, commercial customers, as well as residential customers between now and January of 2003, because the costs of energy are going up. The Public Utility Commission will have to make some decision on rate increase requests, which are pending and which are likely to be filed in the future. But they will not go up by virtue of the fact that Oregon has entered a deregulation effort. They will go up because the costs are going up, and the rates would go up as a result of the process that we've all been accustomed to in the last 60 years of regulated activity, not due to the fact that there's deregulation. And so in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, the governor is in support of House Bill 3983. We hope this would solve the issues surrounding deregulation this session, provide assurances to ratepayers that we are going on a gradual and flexible approach to deregulation, but that over the next period of time till January of 2003, nothing will particularly change for those ratepayers who were covered by Senate Bill 1149. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hemingway, have you had a chance to see the Dash 3 amendments to this bill?
I have not.
Okay. Let me phrase then the question. They propose in Dash 3, it's proposed that the Public Utility Commission can rescind the requirement under the bill to do the cost of, you know, to do a cost of service rate, basically, but then they can rescind the order requiring the market rate to go into effect, providing that it will not a direct access to retail electricity consumers will not result in materially higher electric rates compared to the cost of service rate, and any increase in electricity costs resulting from direct access will not result in substantial curtailment of economic activity or substantial decrease in the number of people employed by customers of electric companies. In other words, those would be the tests that the Public Utilities Commission would use. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Representative March, I would like to have the opportunity to talk that over with others who have some additional experience around Senate Bill 1149, but my initial reaction is that while that amendment has considerable merit with respect to providing flexibility, with respect to individual customers, that is the corner business or the corner factory, they want to know what they are going to have as their rate, and the bill speaks to kind of customers as a whole. And I think one of the anxieties that's out there right now about the language which was in 1149, which allowed for a standard offer, which the PUC has been proceeding with, is that that standard offer means in certain months and in certain to certain customers, their rates might be higher, and to other customers, they might be lower. And so they're not quite sure who gets what. So I think we would want to look very closely to make sure that that bill provided the same level of assurance, or that amendment did, that 3983 does as printed.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you very much.
We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3983. We'll reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 184. And next up will be Pat Schwach. Is Pat here? Okay, let's move to Brad Swank then.
Chair Wilson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm Special Counsel for Government Relations with the State Court Administrator's Office. I'm here today to say that Senate Bill 194, was when it was originally introduced, looked a lot different than it does now. And as it came out of the Senate and picked up its way to head to your committee, we noticed that there were changes. A lot of changes have to do with what court clerks become involved with. And I'm here today to ask for the opportunity to sit down with the people who are working on with this bill. Some technical concerns were raised to me by some of our court clerks and some of our people. We want to chat with them about those, and we want to work out a fair basis to make an assessment of the fiscal impact on this. It looks like there may be some, we're not sure, but we want to sit down and talk with them and go through the bill and make sure where there will be workload impacts and not workload impacts, so you'll have a reasonable idea of what the costs may or may not be associated with this bill in terms of the court. So I'm just here to get to the table on this bill because it looked different in on the other side, and we have an interest. We handle an awful lot of these in the courts every year.
All right, any questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Director Repine. Committee, I am going to a short work session after this is run, House Bill 2087. So if you'd hold fast and accept the amendments, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I am Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services, here and to support and testify on Senate Bill 194. As Ms. Seeleaf mentioned to the committee, this is a large coalition of participants that have spent countless hours working through the details of very many times very difficult, very different-sided opinions to come up with what I believe are well-thought-out, comprehensive solutions to issues that affect our tenants and our residents in the state of Oregon. My agency has the opportunity to be involved because of the Ombudsman Program, and we do facilitate those meetings. The coalition themselves pretty well conducts the activities and come to their conclusions. But we have had that opportunity to have that working relationship with them. And to a person who participates in this activity, who's spent an enormous amount of time, they're all to be commended for that work and their diligence in this issue. And I'd also suggest that the chair should also be recommended or commended on his ability to step in and seize the moment when the group was faltering a little bit to bring them back to a situation that finally has brought this current version or amendment to you.
Thank you. Questions? All right. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate your question. Pat Schwach, please. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Pat Schwach, and I represent Manufactured Homeowners of Oregon. I'm sorry I was missing. I was up the hall working on another bill. In any event, we're happy to see this bill coming forward, and certainly, again, we owe Chair Wilson a debt of gratitude for dragging us all back in, kicking and screaming to keep working on this. And we'll hope that we have a work session here come next week.
Thank
but
you.
We're in favor of it.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. John Brenneman, do you have anything for us? Okay. Thank you. All right. With that said, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 194. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2087, waiting for Representative Close. Committee, let's dig in those bill files for just a moment and take a look at what we have there.
Members, you should have a dash 6 amendment. It was at your place. It's not in your folder. Okay. And my understanding from the fiscal office, the dash 6 amendments remove the postage requirement. So my understanding from the fiscal office is that the fiscal will be significantly lower. There may be some small expense on the fiscal report, but not as there was in the original bill.
If we could have Representative Close come forward and tell us a bit about those dash 6.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm back again.
You're welcome.
Appreciate you hearing about 2087 one more time. We're up to the dash 6 amendments. I hope you've all got them. The major change is that we have deleted the postage requirement for the state to pay the postage. I still believe it's a good idea, but practically, with our money so limited this session, I decided that it was probably not achievable. So that's been removed from the dash 6s. I've also met with the Secretary of State, and they've asked me for a number of changes, which I have made. In Section 1, they asked that a word be changed in line 19 to the county clerk shall maintain a locked, secure receptacle. Before, the wording indicated that they were afraid they'd have to stand there all night. So we made it clear that they're maintaining it, but they don't have to stand over it. On page 4, in subsection 9A, it's subsection 9B, we added, they had a concern that people who were adopted, who were stepchildren or stepparents, should be included in immediate family, and that wasn't clear, so I added that.
Okay.
Page 5 is the same, I believe, although we did take out that when they update the registration, they do not have to provide the evidence of citizenship and residence and age and identity. The way it read, it indicated that to update, you would have to submit it again, so we changed that. Then on page 9, it's under the challenge legislation, the challenge section of the bill. Section 7, we made it clear what they could be challenged on, and can't find the line, but it has to do with they're not qualified. Well, yeah, it's line 27-28, or is otherwise not qualified to be an elector, which means they have either voted. They've already voted, or they don't haven't met the qualifications. So you can't just run in and challenge them because you don't like their looks.
Okay.
We tried to spell that out. And that, those are the major changes in the dash 6. I believe the rest is the same.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Close? Okay, thank you very much.
Appreciate that.
Thank you for your work on this. I appreciate that. I think Secretary of State's office asked to say a few words, and if you would, please. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Patty McGuire, Deputy Secretary of State. While there are improvements in this, in the Dash 6 amendments over the Dash 5 amendments, we still oppose major portions of this, and I'll be happy to run through them quickly. The Section 1 changes, we believe they are acceptable but unnecessary. I think this is a solution in search of a problem, and there just has not been a single documented case of someone turning a ballot over to another individual and it not being passed. We think that this is unnecessary. Turning to page 4, we believe this is unnecessary. We believe that neighbors should be able to help neighbors, and that a blood relationship to help someone is too high a bar to set. I'm also concerned that how there is no direction here as to what a clerk should do with a ballot that's turned in by another person. So I walk into the clerk's office with 500 ballots. Is the clerk to disenfranchise those 500 people? That's not clear. I mean, it's clear I've committed a civil penalty. I would be subject to $200 fines for doing that. But are the people who entrusted their ballot to me disenfranchised? That's not clear. If we're going to proceed with this, we'd like that to be clarified. But on the whole, we think it's unnecessary. Section 3 is in direct violation of the National Voter Registration Act. We would be subject to lawsuit in federal court were we to enact this. The only possible way to enact something like this would be to set up a dual registration system where identification or proof of citizenship was necessary to register to vote in a state election and not unnecessary to vote in a federal election. This would be an incredible administrative nightmare for the county clerks to administer. We strongly oppose the adoption of that section. Section 6 and 7 are, again, acceptable, but we believe unnecessary. I am concerned that adopting a stronger voter challenge process than we currently have, which is incidentally rarely utilized. I mean, it's available, but rarely utilized. I'm concerned that we bring on into Oregon the sort of voter intimidation that is seen in other parts of this country, where new voters, new citizens are challenged at the polls and end up turning and walking away because they're afraid to get in trouble. And I see this sort of challenge system as welcoming that. Finally, in Section 8, on the top of page 11, Section 2 changes the registration requirement in that a person who moves between counties in the last 21 days before the election would not be able to get a ballot in their new county of residence, but a person who moves within a county would. This sets up a pretty serious equal protection issue, whereby if I was a Marion County resident, I could move from Salem to Detroit in the last 20 days and still vote, but if I moved from within the city of Salem, but into Polk County, I wouldn't be able to vote. And I think that's a pretty serious problem. That's the extent of my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Yeah, I would like to go back to one issue. I'm not real concerned about the areas that are perceived as unnecessary because I tend to like a lot of those. But I do want to ask you about Section 3 again. I'm a little troubled by that. I thought that we had steered away from violating the Voters' Rights Act by the changes made there in Section 3.
Scott, do you want to come up? Scott Tye,
sure,
is much more of an expert into the intricacies of NBRA than I am.
Chair Wilson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Scott Tai, Operations Manager for the Elections Division. Chair Wilson, the part of Section 3 that runs afoul of the National Voter Registration Act is that by requiring any type of proof of identity, age, U.S. citizenship, or residence address beyond what is already required on the voter registration card, whether it's a state of Oregon card or the federal card, where you affirm or you attest to the truthfulness of the information on the card, is a violation of the NAVRA Act. So by completing the card with your name, residence address, birth date, and signing the card under the penalty of up to a Class C felony, the NAVRA Act prohibits us from asking for any additional information upon completing that card and signing the card.
Representative Starr.
Thank you. Does anyone ever check or is it against the NVRA to check?
Chair Wilson, Representative Starr, by check you mean verify their
citizenship.
Chair Wilson, Representative Starr, if we were to get a complaint by a citizen challenging the citizenship and providing written evidence, we would open up an investigation and check to see if that person was in fact a citizen.
Any further questions? Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either one of you can answer this, but current law allows for challenge of voters. Is that correct?
Chair Wilson, Representative March, that is correct. Any citizen can challenge another citizen's vote at when the vote comes in. Well, it used to be at the polls now, and then vote by mail at the clerk's office.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
I believe we're making some progress on this. I want to bring this back one time. I want an opportunity to talk to Representative Close about a couple of points here, but all in all, I...
Can I just make a couple of comments?
Yeah, feel free. Come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Betsy Close, State Representative in 36. Just to make a couple things clear, I will do the research on this National Voter Registration Act, but as I showed you, I passed out the Louisiana website where they are asking these questions to vote in Louisiana. So I'm questioning, they're saying this is illegal, but they're doing it in Louisiana. So I think we need to confirm that because I have my doubts. As far as the challenge goes, it's challenging the registration, not the vote. There's a difference there. And this is because on Election Day in Benton County, there was a number of people changing their registration. So that's what this is about, not challenging the vote, but the registration.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We'll bring this back just as quickly as possible and my extension to finish it up.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2087. And with nothing left to do, we are adjourned.